We'll now hear the next case, Mary DeShell. May I proceed?
May it please the court. My name is Mary Avery Moses. I am the attorney today on behalf of the petitioner, Rainer Shell. My case is one of the three that has the identical issue on cert, but this is the case that has the additional issue concerning the retrospective application of 16.2 to a case that was concluded prior to the enactment of the new rule on January 1st, 2005. So I'll just remind the court, in the Shelp matter, a petition was originally filed in April of 2003. A decree of dissolution was entered in May 2004, and then permanent orders dividing the marital property were entered on June 15, 2004. It was that June 14, 2004 order that affirmed the stipulation of the parties that they would each receive one half of the marital portion of the AMPAX pension. I'm going to address the first issue first, but perhaps briefly, since the other cases are dealing with it as well. I think the Court of Appeals erred in two respects in its analysis in Roberts and then in Shell. The first is that the Court of Appeals did not start with the presumption that laws have a prospective application. I think what that panel did was they started with the, well, let's interpret the enacting language. Let's see what that enacting language says and decide from there whether it looks like it was a prospective or a retrospective application. I think they failed in their analysis to start from the presumption that this is prospective. You don't see anywhere in those opinions any deference to the fact that we presume things are prospective. The second area where the Court of Appeals erred was by not looking at the rule as a whole. When the court was looking at the intent, whether it was retro or prospective, the court just really focused on that enacting language. The court did not conduct an analysis of the rule as a whole, and I believe that was the fundamental error. Because when you do look at the entire rule as a whole, you see that this is a new procedure and that these new procedures are going to apply moving forward. I think Justice Martinez had the most accurate interpretation of what that enacting language in conjunction with the entire rule, how that was intended to play out. As I understand the rule when you take it as a whole. Well, and let me actually back up for 1 second. Continental Tire provides that unless a contrary intent is expressed in the statute, changes in procedural law are applicable to existing causes of action, not merely to those which may accrue in the future. So I think the general framework is that unless this court said this isn't going to apply to all cases, that you would assume that even if you're in the middle of a divorce, these new procedural rules will apply to the cases that are ongoing. I believe what the enacting language was intended to provide was that if you've got a divorce case that is ongoing or a post-decree case that is ongoing and you're doing your disclosures under 26.2, that's fine. We are not going to give you a new set of procedural rules. You all finish your case under the old procedural rules. But if you are bringing a new action for a dissolution or legal separation, or if you are bringing a new post-decree action, for example, you have some old child support orders that need to be modified, those new actions are going to be governed by 16.2. And here's what that means. That means you all are going to have status conferences. You're going to have judicial case management. Here's how you're going to disclose your experts. All of those new procedural aspects of the rule. And importantly, you are going to have a new heightened duty of disclosure. I'll come back to that, Justice Bender, in terms of whether it's a heightened duty or not. But you've got these new duties, and you have to affirmatively present all material information to the other side without being asked. This is your new affirmative duty.
What do you do with the fact that rules are procedural in nature and statutes are substantive in nature?
This goes to my constitutional argument. But if a rule, even though it appears to be procedural, affects a substantive right, it is subject to the constitutional prohibition against retrospective application. So you can't just say this is a rule of civil procedure, therefore we don't have to worry about retrospective application. You have to look at what does this procedural rule do substantively. Does it take away a vested right, or does it impose a new duty? And in Mr. Shelp's case, the answer to both of those questions is yes. He had a new duty imposed on him after the fact, and then they took away his vested property right in his pension.
Well, are you saying that there is no difference between substance and procedure?
No.
How do we figure out what's substance and what's procedure?
You have to look at... You have to look at all the case law, I'm afraid. And it's complicated. How you define something as if it has to do with a remedy, then we consider it procedural. But this is not a remedy. You have to look at whether this rule operates to take away a vested right. And here it does, because Colorado case law clearly establishes that once you have a final judgment, and it can be a final judgment in a divorce, those are vested rights. I'm specifically referring to Balanson and Wolford, those two marriage cases. In Wolford, it was a pension. This man was awarded his military pension before we decided that military pensions were property. He got to keep his because that was a vested right. Just like Mr. Shelp had a final judgment in his AMPAX pension.
Isn't your argument that you certainly don't have a final judgment with it under the old rules within 60 days, right?
Not 60 days, but within 6 months.
Well, 6 months, sorry. Right.
But yeah,
So certainly you can reach back there. So your real issue here is whether or not it reaches back.
Right. And if you remember, my final property order was June 15th, 2004. Rule 60, nobody appealed. Rule 60 ran on December 15th, 2004. This was not enacted until January 1st. So whether it was on June 15th or December 15th, regardless, Mr. Shelp had a final judgment he could take to the bank prior to the enactment of this rule. One final point I want to follow up on in terms of how I view the operation of this reach back, given the prospective sense of this rule. The reach back is prospective. If when you are doing your post-decree child support modification, if you, after 2005, and you are not affirmatively disclosing some sort of material information, then whatever judgment you get from that post-decree child support modification, that is then subject to a five-year reach back. Right? So that's when you interpret the rule as a whole.
I guess I have difficulty with your argument in that I thought that the parties always had a duty to be honest in their disclosures.
They do. And in the Shelp case, there was no finding of misrepresentation. There was no finding of fraud or anything like that. The facts in the Shelp case, I think, are very important. Mr. Shelp filed his financial affidavit. He said, I have an AMPAX pension. I'm not hiding that. I've got an AMPAX pension. He says, I don't know what it's worth. All the documents are in her basement. He then because he was trying to settle this case. He goes to AMPACS and he says, how much is this pension worth? They say, oh, you know, when you retire, it might be $777 a month. He then writes to his wife's attorney and says, as you can see, the AMPACS pension is very small, and other than 1 year of service during the marriage, entirely Mr. Shelf's separate property. He said, I have a huge separate property interest. What he didn't do in my case was to say, it's 12 years of premarital and 3 years of marital. That was what he didn't do. That's why his disclosure was incomplete. There was absolutely nothing in 16.2 that said, Mr. Shelf, you have the affirmative duty to go back and find out your date of hire and find out how many years are premarital and how many are marital. If someone had asked him the question, Mr. Shelf, how many years were you employed by this company, he would have had a duty to be candid about that, but no one asked. And that's where the difference is. This is a heightened duty of disclosure. He absolutely complied with his obligations under 16.2. He told them everything he knew. What he didn't...
Well, that's not quite true, is it? He knew how long he worked there and when he worked there, didn't he?
I'm not going to argue that because...
I think most people know when they started.
Well, that's right. But this was three companies that kept taking each other over. So I think that there was serious confusion between both parties. I mean, he only thought there was 1 year of marital when it turns out that there were three. But my point is that he absolutely complied with the rules as they existed. He didn't go out and find additional information and offer that up. But that wasn't his duty.
But the whole purport of these laws is to have a fair and equitable division, right?
That's right.
Okay, so why isn't it perfectly plausible that the court intended at this enlarged period of time for raising this kind of an issue, that it goes right to the heart of what the statute intends to do, changes in a remedial sense, since the court can change its rules, suspend its rules, give a longer period for opening up this very question?
That's right. And if this court or the panel that adopted the rule had intended it to be retrospective,
retroactive. There's a difference between retroactive and retrospective.
Absolutely, and I do mean retroactive. It needed to be expressed clearly and unmistakably. Given all of the different interpretations of what this enacting language means, I don't think it is either clear or an unmistakable indication of an intent to apply it retroactively. That being said, when you're trying to decide what the intent was, in I think it's City of Colorado Springs versus Powell, the best way to do it is for there to be an express statement of that yes, we absolutely intend for this to be a retroactive application. We don't have that. Now, I know that's not the end of the story, but that is the best indication, and that is missing here. And again, it is missing from all of the legislative or the rulemaking history. No one talked about this being retroactive. And I think it is impossible, given the confusing enacting language, given the lack of legislative history, to overcome that presumption of prospective application, given that history. I'd like to reserve my remaining time.
You may.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I am Thomas Plogg. I'm here on behalf of the appellee / respondent, Kathy Shell. I think there's an important distinction that needs to be made right from the outset before following the course of my argument that I intended to make, and that is that both counsel for Mr. Roberts and Ms. Avery Moses in her arguments or in her pleadings have specified that, well, 16.2E10 is okay or would appear to be okay if it is being applied only to motions for modification of child support or maintenance, were, I believe, the examples given. And it just caught my eye in listening to the arguments today that 16.2E10 indicates a duty to provide full disclosure of material assets and liabilities. And why that is important is because assets and liabilities, while they may have some peripheral importance in terms of collections or hiding income or passive income in a modification setting, assets and liabilities in these types of cases are more germane or more permanent as a matter of litigating these cases as a matter of permanent orders in terms of dividing the marital estate. So I think that based on that language, that 16.2E10 is not something that this court should presume is meant to apply strictly to motions for modification.
Well, isn't that consistent with your opposing counsel's position? If you have a whole brand new case, a motion to modify, you have a whole brand new set of discovery, and if you filed it after the January 1st, 05 date, well, it's like a brand new case for all intents and purposes. And so those new disclosures, the new disclosure obligation kicks in. You're not looking at anything that happened in the past. You're looking at how at this whole new set of disclosures and what's going to happen in the future as a result of it. And compare that to this particular case where essentially you have a case which is closed and you want it to be reopened, saying that what happened in this closed case didn't meet the new disclosure requirements under the new rule. I mean, I see those as two very different things. And in fact, I think what you're saying is a very good argument, but not for your position.
Well, and I guess not meaning to argue, be disrespectful in any way, but I think that, again, the statement of material assets and liabilities, given that we're talking about assets and liabilities, is not really germane to, again, modification issues.
Well, sure it is. Sure it is, because you have to, first of all, show that there's a change of at least 10%. I mean, maybe the numbers have changed exactly since I was on the bench, but 10% change before you can even get into that issue, and then you have to recalculate exactly what the change has been for child support or maintenance purposes. So you are very much getting into a brand new case, a brand new set of financial circumstances.
And I wasn't attempting to argue that you are not looking at a brand new set of financial circumstances. I agree that a change in circumstances that would generate a 10% change, at least for child support purposes, is relevant under this rule or 20.
Sure. So if you're looking at a brand new case and you cheat on your disclosures, well, then the brand new order that results as a result of the modification, you can go back 5 years on that. But it doesn't make sense that you should be able to go back, to me at least, that you'd be able to go back 5 years on something where that there wasn't that kind of heightened disclosure requirement prior to the new rule.
Understood. And I guess that from a practitioner's standpoint in terms of litigating child support cases, divorce cases as a matter of permanent orders, etc., in a child support modification, the only reach back would be to seek an adjustment of the support amount or the maintenance amount, not really to get into a reallocation of the marital assets that were divided as a permanent matter of permanent orders.
But if you were going to be seeking that kind of a readjustment, you would have to entirely recalculate the financial status of the parties vis-a-vis each other.
I agree, at least.
And that's the kind of disclosure that we're talking about, the disclosure that would take place at that point. And if there is some kind of fraud or other sort of misrepresentation with respect to the disclosure at that point, which happened after January 1st, 1905, well, then you ought to be able to, 2 or 3 years later, 08 or 09, say, hey, you didn't disclose it correctly to me in this motion to modify, which you filed after this new rule, knowing that there was going to be this heightened disclosure requirement. And that makes sense.
And in regard to the issue as a whole, I mean, I have to agree with Mr. Bittman, counsel for, I believe, the appellee on the Roberts case, that effectively what was changed is not the duty to disclose, because under 26.2 or this rule, there was and always has been an absolute duty to fairly and fully disclose assets and debts, whether premarital or not, but simply a change in the documentation that had to be provided to supplement the affidavit or initial disclosure. And I think that is relevant in terms of the opposing side's argument specifying that some sort of right has been impacted or that an additional duty has been created. It's merely a change in the documentation that has to be submitted. And I would also submit that in terms of a right, be a vested right being impacted, that certainly Mr. Shelp had a right in the pension, the marital share of the pension, and even the premarital share of the pension. But at the moment the parties married, so did Mrs. Shelp, and that right from the second they married forward was always subject to being changed or qualified under the statutes and by the trial court or even a higher court under the circumstances under Rule 60B, 60B2, or even potentially, as was pointed out in the Roberts opinion, under Rule 60B5 if there were extraordinary circumstances. And I would argue or at least suggest that that may have been the case here, because under Rule 26.2 as it existed at the time that the Shelp case was initially being litigated, and if I'm remembering correctly, it had been changed very shortly before that, the trial court had the power to effectively say yes or no to any request to conduct discovery, and Ms. Shelp was in fact denied the right to conduct any discovery, therefore hamstringing her ability to further delve into anything beyond the initial disclosure that was made by Mr. Shelp. And I believe factually at all points, even in documentation he submitted to the gentleman who was ordered or directed or agreed upon to prepare the qualified domestic relations order portioning out the pension, that he only had a very small premarital portion. In terms of addressing the committee's intent, I believe I agree with the Court of Appeals in Roberts and in this case that the plain language indicates for post-decree motions filed on or after January 1st, 2005. And if that is not enough express intent for this court, I believe that in City of Golden or Parker versus City of Golden, which is an opinion handed down by this court, and also Abramite versus Denver Services Board, that both those cases indicate that intent need not be expressed. And while, again, I agree with the Court of Appeals in Roberts that it was expressed or is expressed by the language of the comments, it should also be implied based on the fact that there is no language issued by the committee or by this court adopting the proposed rule specifying, well, then this old rule is going to continue to apply under these circumstances, or only part of the new rule applies to these cases. And I think that that is particularly telling because in my experience, or under at least knowing several of the members of the committee, these are very seasoned family law practitioners who understand that these cases are ongoing potentially into a second decade, and that under these circumstances, there would have absolutely been a need to maintain the old rule rather than repealing it in full. And so I believe that under totality of the circumstances, the tests from cases such as DeWitt and Ficarra in terms of whether this is a constitutionally retrospective and therefore impermissible application as opposed to a retroactive application, if you apply the test to the facts in this case, that we have a retroactive application, and that the rule merely is procedural in nature, and its application is procedural as it doesn't take away a right, as I specified previously, and it does not create any duty, or no further duty or burden was heaped upon Mr. Shelp. Merely the trial court said, all right, I presume you had a duty to fully disclose whether we're talking about X, Y, or Z document being exchanged, and whether we want to call it intentional or not, that duty was not adhered to, and now this new procedural rule, clearly procedural rule, creates a remedy under which Ms. Shelp may seek relief. So from our perspective, we don't see anything unconstitutionally impermissible, and don't believe that there's any real question as to the intent of the committee in proposing the rule in the form of the
So what you're really, to just recharacterize it, what you're really arguing is that the wife was divested of her share of the pension solely by the operation of Rule 60, and this rule relieved that to allow that to be reopened. I mean, is that a way to look at it too? I mean, the argument here was that it vested when there was a final judgment and the 6 months had expired. So isn't wife asserting that in fact she was done out of the her share of the pension by the operation of Rule 60?
I would submit that to an extent, but for the court in Roberts citation to the Seeley case in Rape and Marriage of Seeley concerning the potential of applicability of Rule 60.B5 in this exact type of case. Mm-hmm. But I would say that, that certainly by operation of Rule 60, she was divested potentially of a right to seek further relief based on the lack of full disclosure of the pension. And that if you look at the entirety of the rule as it was adopted and the comments and everything else, the legislative intent or the committee's intent and this court's intent, presumably in adopting the rule, was to remedy these types of abuses. And even if the court were to find that there is a vested right, I believe, as is specified in Parker versus City of Golden, that if there is a rational basis for the enactment of the new rule or application of the rule, then that can overcome even the impact on a vested right. And I believe that the rational basis in this case and in similar cases would be that there is, as a public policy matter, a need for the fair administration of justice in these cases, not just for the protection of the particular litigants or parties in this case, but also as a means of keeping the trial courts flowing as best as they can, particularly in this type of case that, unlike many civil and criminal cases at the trial level, can be ongoing for years and years and years and years. And this creates a means, or certainly I would presume was intended, as per the Colorado Lawyer article, A Brave New World, to give the trial court some teeth and to send a message to practitioners that you need to be counseling your clients that this type of stuff is not going to be tolerated any further, and we're not going to continue to just litigate and litigate. We're going to do something about this at this point and level the playing field and create a greater remedy. And it is truly remedial in nature. And I would also like to reserve the remainder of my time.
You don't get to do that. You're in the responding position. So you use it or lose it.
And I have not been before this court before, so I do apologize for that misstep on my part. I don't believe I have anything further to add to my argument, though.
Okay.
I just have a few points to address. The first is that Mr. Shelp's interest in his AMPAC's pension was independent of any statute or procedural rule. He had his right to that pension by virtue of his employment. It is akin, I was looking at the case, I believe it's Colorado Springs versus Towel, that was talking about attorney's fees and that those are, there's a right to those that's separate from a statute. That was his interest in this pension. And so it was a vested right. Even if the court thinks that there is some public policy reason for going in and taking his vested property right, if there's some sort of public policy that is implicated and is not sufficiently covered by Rule 60B. I mean, there is a remedy, right? There is the 60B remedy. They just passed their time on that. But if there is some sort of public policy, I'd remind the court that he is being wronged on both fronts. One is the vested property right, and the other is the imposition of a new duty. I mean, those two are inextricably combined in this case.
How is there a new duty? He's always had the duty to be honest in his disclosures.
And there was no finding that he was dishonest. The only finding is that his disclosure was incomplete.
Okay,
he did not specify how many years were premarital and how many years were marital.
I don't think that you need to find wrongdoing to find that the disclosure was incomplete or inaccurate. So I don't see why that's a change in duty. It needs to have that same duty under the statute.
He did not.
Day before this rule became effective?
He did not. Under 16.2, and case law interpreting it, there is no requirement that you disclose the number of years that were premarital and the number of years that were marital. It simply doesn't exist.
Okay.
My time is up.
On behalf of the court, I thank you for your arguments. Case will stand submitted.